Good evening. Welcome to WCVE Forum. I'm Benjamin Dolly. Tonight we hear Stuart Eisenstadt, co-author of The Future of the Jews, How Global Forces Are Impacting the Jewish People, Israel, and Its Relationship with the United States. Eisenstadt is a former Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Ambassador to the European Union, and Special Representative on Holocaust-era issues. His speech was hosted by a partnership of the World Affairs Council of Greater Richmond, First Freedom Center, the Jewish Community Federation of Richmond, and the Virginia Holocaust Museum. The president of the First Freedom Center, retired Ambassador Randolph Bell, presided. It was recorded May 22nd at the Weinstein Jewish Community Center.
Thank you very much, Randy. I only wish my mother were here to hear this. I know that I can be understood today because you're from Richmond and I'm from Atlanta, so there's no problem of translation. It's really a pleasure to be with Randy. And Randy has really organized this. He headed the Office of Holocaust Issues at the State Department, which I helped create. And we worked together on numerous activities. And many of the accomplishments which he mentioned were really as much Randy's as they were mine. He heads the First Freedom Center, which is one of the sponsors here. I appreciate their sponsorship and the World Affairs Council, which is a terrific organization. I've spoken at World Affairs Councils from now Richmond to California, and they do a great service. The Virginia Holocaust Museum, and I was responsible, if I may put it that way, for being one of the fathers of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington. It was my memorandum in April of 1978 to President Carter, urging that there be a presidential commission headed by Elie Wiesel to recommend a permanent memorial for Holocaust victims in Washington, which led directly to the museum. So I have a special affiliation and affection for the Virginia Museum as well. And the Federation of Jewish Communities, which is also a sponsor. I've been very active with our federation in Washington. And we're in the JCC of Richmond. And I was president of the JCC of Greater Washington in 1989 to 1991. So I have all sorts of affiliations and networks with the organizations and with you here. We live in a new century of astonishing change. Change taking place in more areas of human endeavor, more rapidly than at any time in history. The traditional moorings upon which we all have based our lives are shifting, and they're causing seismic changes in every aspect of what we do and in the relationship of nations as well. And I want to explore with you tonight, as I do in my book, the major global forces of this new era through the prism of their impact on the United States, which is Israel's strongest supporter, the State of Israel, and the Jewish people. Jews have played an outsized role in history of the world. Never have so few accomplished so much for so many, and yet suffered so grievously. Two Jewish states were destroyed, one by the Babylonians, the other by the Romans. Jews were cast asunder to the four corners of the world, living at the mercy of tyrants and mobs, expelled from numerous countries starting in 1290 from England, subject to gross discrimination and unprecedented violence, and ultimately a Holocaust in our own lifetime, which destroyed two-thirds of what had then been the center of Jewish life in Europe, fully a third of the total Jewish population. No other people could have survived such calamities, let alone thrived, even in countries which didn't want Jews. But attachments to Holy Scripture, to the redemption of a Jewish homeland in Israel, and a remarkable sense of peoplehood have allowed Jews not only to survive, but to thrive when the empires which sought to destroy the Jewish people have themselves perished. And now, miraculously, after 2,000 years of living at the mercy of others, at the margins of society, the Jewish people have re-entered the mainstream of history in a new Jewish state founded on the very same land from which two previous commonwealths were destroyed, and integrated, particularly in the United States, in ways that no other country has ever welcomed Jews. More on that in a little while. But now, in the 21st century, we face a whole new set of challenges, particularly because of the tiny number of Jews in the world, less than 0.2% of the world's population. There were 17 million Jews in the world in 1939. There are 13 million today, one of the few peoples anywhere that has fewer people today than in 1939. We've never recovered from the 6 million that we lost. And we are vulnerable also because the Jewish state remains in a hostile region. And so the global forces I'm going to describe have particular impacts on Jews and on Israel, but they also very much affect the United States. So let's talk about the what I call first external global forces of the 21st century, the first of which is a dramatic historic shift of power and influence from the United States and Europe, which have sizable Jewish populations and a long history of relationship with Jews and Israel, to countries in the East and in the South, which have virtually non-existent Jewish populations and no real emotional ties to Israel. Countries like China and India, Brazil, and other emerging powers. While the 20th century was the Atlantic century, dominated by the United States in particular, but Europe as well, the 21st century will almost certainly be the Asian and Pacific century. A new global order is rising before our very eyes. It's impossible to overstate the importance of a continued strong United States to the Jewish people and to the state of Israel. Indeed, the security of Israel and Jews everywhere is inextricably intertwined with the strength of the United States. The U.S. is Israel's only real ally, and since the end of World War II, we in the United States have been the ballast for world order and stability, growth, tolerance, and freedom. For virtually all of our history as the American people, our country has been the ascending power, even from the first days of the post-revolution in the late 18th century and early 19th century. We were always ascending relative to other countries, and then we caught and eclipsed them by the end of World War II, becoming the predominant power in the world in every possible area. What has changed now is not that we are a declining power. We will remain the predominant power in the world for decades to come, for reasons I'll describe. But what has changed is we are no longer the ascending power. Other countries are ascending and challenging our lead in every area: military, education, economic, and political. And since the end of the Cold War, these newly emerging powers have created what is called a multipolar world. with multiple power centers, and that's rarely happened in the world. There have been predominant powers, the Spanish, the Dutch, the British, depending on who won particular wars. Now there are multiple powers, each seeking their own day in the sun, each wanting their own direction, their own policy, not willing to necessarily follow our lead as they were for decades after the end of World War II. And nowhere is this clearer, as I'll describe, than in the area where Israel most depends for American leadership, the Middle East. There's a term that's been given that exemplifies this first global force of the shift of power, and that is the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China. They now have 40% of the world's population, almost a quarter of the world's growth. By 2030, which is not very far away, Asia will have three-fifths of all the growth in the world. And this year, 2012, this very year, will be the first year in recorded history in which newly emerging countries will produce more output of goods and services than the traditional major industrial democracies. Our closest allies are weakening. We see it in the headlines every day in the European crisis. And our closest ally in Asia, Japan, has gone through two decades of stagnant growth, and because of declining population, in the middle of this century, they will have half the population they do today. One of the great stories which exemplifies this first global force is the rise of China in the early part of the 21st century. In only the last 5 years, they've leapfrogged first Germany, then Japan, to become the second largest economy in the world, and well before the middle of this century, perhaps as early as 2035. They will surpass us as the largest economy. India is already the fifth, and just within the last few months, Britain overtook the UK as the sixth largest. Brazil overtook the UK as the sixth largest economy. China is already number one in numerous categories. The fastest supercomputers, the largest amount of foreign reserves, the biggest producer of steel, the largest manufacturer of cars. We could go on and on. The largest manufacturer of solar panels and wind turbines, which will power our alternative energy. And humorously, perhaps, they've just overtaken Italy. And what is Italy number one in? Violin making. Well, now China's the biggest manufacturer of violins. The world in which we will all live as Americans and as Jews, and in which Israel will heavily depend on the ability of the United States and China to find a viable relationship. Napoleon once said, when you're around China, let her slumber, because when she awakes, the earth will shake. He said that 250 years ago. And our ability to manage the relationship with this Middle Kingdom will be critical to all of us. It's a unique relationship. We have very close relationships with allies like the British, like the Israelis. We had a Cold War with a genuine enemy, the Soviet Union. But our relationship with China is unique. They're neither friend nor foe. But we are mutually dependent, joined at the hip like Siamese twins. We're one of their largest markets. They hold more dollars outside of the United States than any other country. They're sort of our global banker. There is no problem in the world, including in the Middle East, that can be solved without cooperation between the U.S. and China. It's a fierce competition between two different cultures, two different histories, two different value systems, two different ways of governing. We with our free market democratic system, they with their communist top-down state capitalist system. And frankly, we have left ourselves a very deep hole with the Great Recession, which will take years to come out of, And it gives the Chinese bragging rights in the world that their model of state-down capitalism works better than ours. And one of the reasons I feel so intensively about the need for bipartisan cooperation to deal with our fundamental problems is we mustn't let the Chinese get the advantage and try to teach the world that their system rather than ours is the better system. The rise of so many powers makes the management of this new system extremely difficult and extremely complex. But let me give you some good news. And the good news is that, yes, our relative advantage is clearly being reduced. But we are not a beached whale. We are not the Britain depleted after World War II and exhausted. With all of our problems, and I could spend the whole night talking about them, we remain the largest economy, the most creative and innovative economy. We remain the country with the greatest universities. If you want an example of that, half of China's Politburo have their children and grandchildren not in Beijing University, in American universities. Over 100,000 Chinese this very moment are in American universities. Our dollar will remain the world currency for decades to come. We are the only country that can project air, sea, and land power simultaneously to any corner of the world. And our defense spending, even with the budget cuts inevitably coming up, exceeds the next 16 countries, including China, put together. So we have enormous assets. And indeed, I wouldn't want to trade our problems for any other countries. Let's take China as an example. You know, we tend to see now, and I mentioned the number of places China's number one, was sort of this unstoppable behemoth. Well, the fact is, China has major problems too. They are an aging society, officially an aging society, and their demographic profile is worse than ours. We're going to have 400 million people in the next 30 years. China's population, while huge, of course, at 1.25 billion, will stagnate. They will have fewer workers to support more retirees. They have tremendous ethnic unrest among their Muslim population in the West and among the Tibetans. They had over 100,000 demonstrations in 2011 against corruption, against land grabs, against the feeling that the Communist Party is not playing right, is not playing on an equal playing field with others. They have an increasingly large middle class that is chafing under the internet restrictions they're placed. And former Chinese allies in their own region in Asia, like Vietnam, with whom we fought a bloody war only a few decades ago, are coming to us and saying, you've got to protect us against the demands China is making in the South China Sea and elsewhere. And yes, China's the second largest economy, but you know where it stands in a per person income? 133rd. And India is 167th on per capita income. And we have a potential game changer in an area no one would have believed only a few years ago, and that's energy. You know, we've been importing more and more energy from the Middle East. It's skewed our foreign policy to Israel's disadvantage and to our own. That's going to change profoundly over the next 20 years. The new energy environment will be the Western Hemispheric environment, from tar sands in Canada, our great neighbor, to the capacity to get heavy oil and natural gas out of limestone and shale in our own country. We are now the number one producer of natural gas in the world. And when you take the other part of the hemisphere in the south with Brazil's huge resources, we will be less and less dependent on the Arab Middle East oil. And in just the last 3 years, we have bought 20% less, we're 20% less dependent on Saudi Arabia than we were 3 years ago. Israel is very much part of this new global order. Indeed, were it not for its tiny population, Israel would be up there with the BRIC countries. It's got one of the 10 most powerful militaries. It's got an enormously creative and innovative society, one of the highest exports per capita, one of the best university systems. And you remember the old joke we all told when we were kids that Moses took the wrong turn in the desert, should have turned east instead of going west, so he could have got all this oil. Well, that joke is going to be old-fashioned because a Houston-based energy company called Noble Energy, with whom I happen to do some work, has over the last decade and most recently, just a year and a half ago, found three major natural gas fields, the most recent mammoth find properly called the Leviathan. And so Israel's dependence on Egyptian gas, which has now been cut off a half dozen times since the revolution there, will evaporate, and Israel will become a net exporter of natural gas through LNG. Now, with these global shifts in power, it's incumbent that Israel deepen its relationship with these new emerging powers for sure. And it's doing so. Trade with China, with Russia, with India, with Brazil has dramatically increased. And yet, I come back to my basic proposition. With all of that, the United States is still the only solid ally. China, for example, wants military technology from Israel. We won't give it, allow it to be given through our Pentagon. And China always votes with the Arab bloc. Brazil has been at the lead of the Palestinian statehood movement in the UN. And India, although Israel's supply is the third largest supplier of military hardware to India, there has never been an Indian senior official who has visited Israel for fear they will offend their mammoth Muslim minority. So one continues to come back to the fact that the United States and its strength is crucial, and all of us have a great stake as Americans, as American Jews, as supporters of Israel and what we do. The second major global force is globalization itself, by which I mean the remarkably rapid movement of capital and of technology, of products, of services, and of people across national boundaries, often with the push of a mouse on our computer. Trillions of dollars cross national boundaries every day. And indeed, it's the digital revolution and the internet which power this new globalization. It's profoundly changing everything we do as profoundly as Gutenberg's invention of the printing press 500 years ago. The way we work, the way we communicate, the way we learn, the way we do everything. Now, there are dark sides to globalization. Globalization allows, through the internet, terrorist groups to recruit, to finance, and to plan terrorist attacks. Globalization creates income inequalities. Globalization also is responsible for something I deal with in great detail in the book, a new form of warfare called cyber warfare, in which you can disable a whole country by disabling the computers that power everything that we do and every military and civilian system we have, dams and water projects and electricity grids and the like. But permit me to say that globalization is an enormous net benefit for Americans, for Jews worldwide, and for Israel. And the reasons why it is because it can create a more stable, prosperous world. There are today, believe it or not, today, over 4 billion people in this world That's almost two-thirds of the total of 7 billion people who have cell phones. There are over 2 billion people who use the internet every day. And this is not just in the developed countries. It's every village and town in Asia and in Africa. It's connecting people in the tiniest villas who were isolated from the world. It enables them to learn, to like take and take a long-distance learning course from Harvard, from a village in Africa. They can connect to markets for their products. And this also creates a more integrated world, and that is unique in the world. We are all now truly integrated and coordinated. We have a mutual stake in the prosperity of everyone else. Just take your cell phone, whether it's an iPad, an iPhone, or whatever. The iPhone is made in 7 different countries. And everybody says, well, it's, you know, it's a Chinese product, really. It's invented in the United States. No, only 7% of the value of the iPhone you buy is contributed in China. They get inputs from all over the world. And any part of that supply chain, which is interrupted, interrupts what everybody does. There's nothing we use. There's no car we drive. There's no appliance that we use that doesn't have inputs from multiple countries. So we are mutually dependent on each other's stability and prosperity. And that is unique, and that is a very positive thing for us as Americans, and for Jews, and for Israel. And Israel is very much a part of this new globalized world because of its technological capability. And there's another prospect here. And that is when you look at what is going to be the make or break issue for those countries and those peoples who will thrive or fail in this new 21st century globalized world. It's education, it's creativity, it's innovation, it's flexibility, it's adaptability, and those are in the DNA of the American people and certainly in the DNA of the Jewish people, and indeed, it's one of the prime reasons that we still exist after 3,000 years of going through such traumas. So globalization is a net positive. The third global force that we have to contend with is the direction of the 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. 1.6 billion Muslims. The Muslim religion is the fastest growing religion in the world. It's overtaken Catholicism as the largest religion. There are 400 million Muslim Arabs in the Middle East where Israel is located with a population of 7 million. And the direction which the Muslim world takes will speak volumes about the kind of world you and I, our children, our grandchildren, Jews and Israel will face in the years ahead. Now, I want to suggest to you, and here we have to be very careful about how we deal with this subject. Professor Huntington, Sam Huntington at Harvard, talked about famously the war of civilizations between the Muslim world and the Western world. And for sure, we see every day in our headlines examples of that war of civilizations. And the latest jihad attack, and the latest terrorist attack, and the effort by Al-Qaeda and the Taliban and others to drive the United States and all Western influence out of what they consider their holy grail. But I want to stress that if we see the Muslim world through the prism of terrorism, through the prism of a war of civilizations, we may help guarantee that very war. That is not, and I spend a lot of time in the Muslim world, it is not where most of the Muslim world is. The great majority of Muslims want to be integrated into this new global world. They want the technology, the education, the opportunity, the excitement that goes with being a part of it. And I want to suggest to you that more than a war of civilizations between the Muslim and the Western world, what we often see, even in the jihadist part of it, is a war within the Muslim world for the direction that world will take between the modernizers and the fundamentalists, between the radicals and the young kids who want a better future, between those who want to blow up the world and those who want to be part of the world and enjoy its opportunities. And our job and Israel's job is to try to enforce and reinforce and strengthen the moderate forces and cauterize the jihadists and the radicals. There were two recent UN human rights reports on the Arab world written by Arab scholars, not by some Western professor at Princeton. And it's an enormous self-indictment of how far the Arab and the Muslim world, but particularly the Arab world, has fallen behind every region, including Africa, in every field of endeavor: education, jobs, governance, corruption. One of the little anecdotes in that study, which to me sort of concretizes this, there are more books translated each year into Greek than into Arabic. Can you imagine? And this was, when you add also the youth bulge, a third of the Arab population is under 20 years old. And these kids don't have jobs, they don't have economic opportunity, they don't see a future, and therefore they're attracted oftentimes to radicalism. That's what the Arab Spring was all about. The kindling wood was already there when this lowly street peddler in Tunisia burned himself and ignited a revolution that is as profound and will have as much impact on us as the revolution in Central and Eastern Europe 20 years ago, which brought down the Soviet Union. There was, before the Arab Spring, a sort of neat division between the pro-American Gulf states and autocratic regimes, the Egypts and so forth, on the one hand, supporting in one way or another the peace process with Israel, supporting our policy, and on the other hand, the Irans and Syrias and their terrorist surrogates like Hamas and Hezbollah. That neat division is exploded by the Arab Spring. It's like somebody took a deck of playing cards and just threw them up in the air, and it's landing in unusual places that we still can't quite fathom. There is some cause for optimism. If you look in Saudi Arabia, for example, there's a new King Abdullah University of Science and Technology with a co-ed student body, with faculty from all over the world, the same things happening in the UAE and elsewhere, trying to become part of this world. How the Arab Spring comes out will speak volumes for the United States and Israel. I have to say that it has the potential to unleash the creative capacities of the Arab population. It has the potential to empower Arab populations who have been suppressed. But it also has the capacity to turn from an Arab Spring into an Arab winter for the United States and for Israel. Every election that has been held in the Arab Middle East since the Arab Spring has elected an Islamic government, every single one, some more radical, some more moderate. We can say already with some assuredness that this emerging new Islamic order, I don't think is going to take the course of Iran for sure. They need Western technology and so forth, but neither is it going to have the closeness to the United States and to Israel as it had before. And yet, even here, I want to be optimistic, because even though these new Islamic elected governments are not going to be as close to us as they were the governments that they overthrew, they know they can't ignore the United States and the West. These new Islam, and I just came back from a conference in Morocco with a number of countries. They were not elected to put veils over women's faces and impose Sharia law. That is not what their mandate is. Their mandate is good governance, cleaning up garbage, delivering civil service, creating jobs and economic opportunity. And if they don't deliver, they will bear the brunt of public opprobrium. And they know that if they're going to deliver, they need our technology, our money, our assistance. And so we will continue to have influence, although, again, perhaps not what we had before. A fourth global impact, which has particularly impacts on Israel and Jews, is a new form of anti-Semitism. Not the religious-based anti-Semitism of Europe, which led to the Holocaust, but a Muslim anti-Semitism, which cloaks itself as anti-Zionism with UN resolutions and the like. Zionism is racism, they say. And now, more troubling in a way, because this has been a problem for decades, is the growth of a sort of new vintage in which academics, labor unions in Europe, academics and college campuses right here in the United States, and I see it because I speak on college campuses, is that somehow there is an effort to delegitimize Israel as a Jewish state. And our own Randy Bell, in a really brilliant op-ed article in the Richmond Times-Dispatch just a couple of weeks ago, talked about how Gunter Grass, the great German poet, is part of this sort of academic notion of conflating Israel with the worst of societies, in which he, Grass, in effect, says, as Randy really brilliantly notes, that Israel is out to annihilate the Iranian people, using sort of terminology like the Holocaust, when it's Iran that's threatened to wipe Israel off the map and wants the nuclear capacity to do so. You see it in cartoons in which Israeli soldiers are shown with jackboots and Nazi swastikas, putting their boots on the neck of Palestinians. Now, Israel, as any country, has to be subject to criticism for their policies. But as Randy says in this piece, there's no clear line that these forces draw between legitimate criticism of policies and policies that seek to undermine the very nature of Israel as a state for Jews. Natan Sharansky, the great Soviet refusnik and now head of the Jewish Agency, came up with what he calls the three D's to distinguish legitimate criticism from delegitimization. First, is Israel being demonized by having its actions blown out of proportion? Is there a double standard in which Israel is treated differently from other countries? And is the effort an attack not to change Israeli policy, but to deny its legitimacy as a Jewish state? I want to close, before I get to my last topic, with one other external threat, and that is the Iranian nuclear threat, which I just alluded to. There's now a consensus among Western and Israeli intelligence that while Iran does not have the nuclear bomb, it wants to become nuclear capable. That is, to have all the elements, the fuel, the triggers, all the things that are necessary so they can quickly assemble a bomb when they feel they need it. For Iran to have nuclear weapons would be profoundly contrary to the best interests of the United States, the West, and Israel. It would blow up what's left of the non-proliferation treaty. It would tilt the whole Middle East in the direction of radicalism. And it would profoundly impact on the safety and security of Israel. It's critically important that this be stopped. And there is a real effort that I believe is successful to get Iran to the bargaining table. Tomorrow in Baghdad will be the second round of negotiations. Why did Iran decide to go back to the bargaining table? Because the sanctions we have led and the Europeans have followed to their great credit have really disabled the Iranian economy. Their currency has been depreciated by 50%. Oil tankers can't get insurance to bring refined products into Iran or to leave Iranian ports. Their banks have just been expelled from the European banking structure called a SWIFT system. You can't do any business internationally without going through the data transmission system of SWIFT. Their central bank is being targeted, and rightly so, because they help support the nuclear program. If we keep this pressure on, I hope that Iran will come to its senses and recognize that it can't pursue a nuclear weapons path. If it does not, if it's willing to subject its own people to untold suffering, then a military option certainly has to be on the table, but I hope it won't be one led by Israel, but rather one that will have U.S. and global support. I want to close with talking about the internal challenges facing Israel and the Jewish people. I believe, as I've said, every one of these external challenges, every one of the global forces, can be met by the United States, by Israel, and by the Jewish people because we're stronger, more integrated into the countries we live in than ever before, and because we have a Jewish state stronger than any past Jewish state. But it's the internal challenges which I'm most concerned with. It's the old cartoon. I'm sure many of you in this room are too young to remember it, that Al Capp and Pogo said, we met the enemy and it is us. Now, what I'm about to describe, I think, is not just a Jewish issue, because I think anyone who believes that American Jews and Jews in Europe and elsewhere create a positive environment for their country, that they add to the beautiful diversity, the mosaic of differences we have in this country, has to be concerned with the potential that these internal challenges have. And let me put it in this way. There are 5 million Jews in the United States. And we should view ourselves as a sort of enterprise with two divisions. One of the divisions of this 5 million enterprise is vibrant, healthy, engaged, involved in Jewish activities in this Jewish community center, in federations, in Jewish day schools. There are 700 in the United States educating 250,000 Jews. There's a program called Birthright, which sends on their first trip to Israel young people who have never gone before. Now 300,000 young kids have gone with a waiting list. But the other division of this enterprise is morally bankrupt. It's disengaged, uninvolved, assimilating, refusing to assert our own unique culture at the very time America is most willing and anxious to embrace it as a rich part of this mosaic. And this is seen everywhere. Drops in philanthropy by Jews to Jewish causes, not to museums, not to their university, not to the Kennedy Center, not to the Art Museum in New York, but to Jewish philanthropy, to Jewish education, to Jewish community centers, to Jewish federations. And Sam Asher, your CEO for your Jewish Federation, who does such a wonderful job, gave me today, before my talk, a new demographic study which outlines all of this, drops in day school education here, drops in membership in major Jewish organizations. This is a serious problem. Demography can be a dry study, but it is the lifeblood of what I'm talking about. There are 7 billion people in the world today. There are 13 million Jews. There'll be 10 billion people in the world in the middle of this century. There'll still be 13 million Jews, if we're lucky, because of the combination of very low birth rates, intermarriages without conversion, and this requires a new call to arms, a new way of thinking. We have to reach out, and I think this JCC does, to intermarried couples and make them feel a part of the community. Rabbis, in my opinion, should perform intermarriages if the couple will agree that their children are raised Jewish, even if there's no conversion. What good does it do to drive away a couple at the very time they're forming and then to say, well, okay, you can come into the JCC and join? That doesn't work. Jewish education has to be given a top priority, and I call in my book for the creation of a multi-billion dollar education fund to make Jewish education affordable and better. And we need to double the birthright program. There's a new paradigm for this internal challenge, and that is, for the last 60 years, Jews in Europe and the United States and Argentina and Australia gave of themselves, and rightly so, to Israel, to make Israel strong and secure, and that's certainly still necessary. But now Israel is strong, and for the first time, starting just a few years ago, the largest number of Jews live not in the United States, but in Israel. And Israel has a responsibility not just to strengthen itself, but to strengthen the diaspora from which it draws support. And so it needs to be supporting Jewish education and birthright programs that will link ourselves together. There's also a different dimension of demography when we switch to the internal challenges in Israel. The birth rates of Israeli Jews are 50% higher than the birth rate of Jews in the diaspora. It's a very healthy birth rate. But it's 50% lower than the birth rate of Israeli Arabs, now 20% of the population of Israel, and even lower than the birth rate of the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. In the West Bank, over 40% of the 2.5 million Palestinians are under 14 years of age. Okay? 40% are under 14 years of age. 50% of the first graders in Israel today are either Israeli Arabs or the children of ultra-Orthodox, so-called Haredi population, who are not integrated into the workforce, and about whom I'll discuss in a minute. Israel has a profound internal challenge of coming to peace with itself. Now, the bonds that bind Israelis, and I go there 30, 35 times, I'm going twice in the next 2 months, are enormous. Language, peoplehood, serving in the army, a real sense of togetherness. And yet, Israel has yet to come together on the most fundamental issues a nation state has to decide. What do Israelis want their borders to be? not what the United States wants or what the Palestinians, what do they want? Where do they want their boundaries to be? What do they want their relationship to be with their Israeli citizens who are of Arab descent? What do they want their relationship to be with Palestinians? They have to come to a decision and then act accordingly. In a way, it's a sort of contest between those in Israel who want a greater Israel on biblical Israeli land, where unfortunately 2.5 million Palestinians live in one part and 1.5 million in Gaza in the other, or more circumscribed borders, but ones that will guarantee a Jewish democratic majority. Israel has to decide which of those it wants. Now, for sure, Israel can't make peace with the Palestinians itself. I've dealt with the Palestinians. I met with Arafat a half dozen times during the Clinton administration. I was responsible for the economic dimension of the Middle East peace process. I know the Palestinian community. It's divided. It's not willing to make the compromises for peace. But the question is, can we strengthen the moderate forces and accept the notion that the status quo is not acceptable, that ultimately control over 2.5 million Palestinians is not in Israel's security interest? And if we can't get the Palestinians to make peace, then we should follow the medical Hippocratic oath. Do no harm. Don't start expanding settlements further and further, penetrating more and more into Palestinian areas and complicating an eventual ability to make peace. There's one other aspect to this internal challenge, and that is the militant tiny minority among settlers who are burning mosques and Qurans, poisoning Palestinian olive trees, and even attacking Israel's own soldiers in the West Bank there to protect them. The rapidly growing Haredi population, now 8% of the Israeli population, likely 20% in the next 25 years, is not integrated. The men don't work. They don't contribute to the workforce. They don't serve in the army. And most recently, forced public Israeli buses going through their neighborhoods to be segregated between women and men. The deputy health minister recently refused to hand an award to a distinguished female Israeli scientist in a state which has been a pioneer in equality for women in the military service and even with the first female prime minister in the world, Golda Meir. Now, none of this yet threatens Israeli democracy, but now is the time for Israelis to act before it does. One thing I am certain about in this uncertain, changing world, and that is that through whatever change exists, the U.S.-Israel relationship will remain solid because it's based on pillars of public support, not just Jewish support. We're 2% of the population in this country. It's based on American public support for a fellow democracy, for a country willing to tackle terrorism, for a country which is part of the Holy Land. That's the basis of the support, and it's a mutual support. We've had differences going back to the Truman administration, in which he recognized Israel and then refused to give Israel any arms at its maximum danger during the War of Independence, and Israel had to turn to the Czech Republic and to France to win its independence. We've had differences, and we will have differences. But those are differences at the margin. The relationship between our two countries is a magnificent relationship on the intelligence, military, political, diplomatic, and values level, which will be unchangeable. So I believe that not just the external, but the internal challenges can also be overcome. There's so much to build on. Let me conclude with one phrase, and that is from the prophet Jeremiah, who had a vision 2,500 years ago when the first temple was destroyed, and Jews were initially exiled to Babylonia. And he said then, trying to offer hope, I will gather them from the uttermost parts of the world, the blind and the lame among them, women with child and women in travail, a company shall come back there. And remarkably, in our own lifetime, that prophecy has been fulfilled. Empires from Babylonia and Assyria to Romans and Greeks to the Nazis and the Soviets, which tried to destroy the Jewish people, have vanished, while the indomitable, indestructible Jewish people thrives in this country and in Israel and in Europe, and will continue to make contributions to the world far out of proportion to our tiny numbers, both in Israel and in all four corners of the world. Thank you, and I'll be glad to take your questions.
Thank you, Stu. That was enormously instructive and moving. With our usual respect for our honored radio partner, 88.9 FM WCVE, which is recording this for broadcast, I would ask that questions be presented only through the microphone, which Mr. Payton will pass among you. So if you wish to ask a question, please wait for raise your hand and wait for the microphone.
While you're doing that, let me just mention one thing, which is so striking and so unique about the United States. And I lived in Europe. I was ambassador to you. It's very different in Europe even today. We're 2% of the population of this country. But we accounted for 36% of all U.S. Nobel Prize winners and 25% of all the organizations that have gotten Nobel Prizes were created by Jews. 85% of the American Jewish population goes to college, more than twice the national average. And there's hardly a field of endeavor in which we haven't enriched this country, including, and I say this coming to Richmond with your own Congressman, Eric Cantor, as majority leader, disproportionately in the Senate and the House to our population, and with the majority leader of this country and this Congress being Jewish. The congressional calendar is built around not just the Christian, but the Jewish religious cycle as well, and kosher food is among the fastest growing in the market. So there.
You've just heard Stuart Eisenstadt, co-author of The Future of the Jews, How Global Forces Are Impacting the Jewish People, Israel, and Its Relationship with the United States. Eisenstadt is a former Deputy Secretary of the Treasury, Ambassador to the European Union, and Special Representative on Holocaust-era issues. His speech was hosted by a partnership of the World Affairs Council of Greater Richmond, First Freedom Center, the Jewish Community Federation of Richmond, and the Virginia Holocaust Museum. It was recorded May 22nd at the Weinstein Jewish Community Center. Views expressed on WCVE Forum are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the management or staff of WCVE. Thanks to WCVE's Danny Willis for production assistance on tonight's program. I'm Benjamin Dolly. This has been a public affairs presentation of WCVE Public Radio.